Good morning. Thank you all for being here this morning to share something of the Dharma. In our Zen practice, it seems that we sit and study and engage in all other aspects of practice that are available here in order to attain something. We are dissatisfied with our lives and we want to change somehow, but we're not sure how. All we know is that we want to get something somewhere, to become something other than what we are. We want to get enlightened, to attain peace, end suffering, and so on. This is addressed by a koan in the Mumon Kan, the Wu Men Guan. Case number 19. Ordinary mind is the Tao. The case reads, Zhao Zhou asked Nan Zhuan, what is the Tao? Nan Zhuan answered, ordinary mind is the Tao. Zhao Zhou asked, then should I try to direct myself toward it? Nan Zhuan said, if you try to direct yourself toward it, you go away from it. Zhao Zhou asked, how can I know the Tao if I don't direct myself? Nan Zhuan said, the Tao does not belong to knowing or not knowing. Knowing is delusion, not knowing is blankness. If you truly reach the genuine Tao, you will find it as vast and boundless as outer space. How can there be knowing or not knowing in the Tao? At these words, Zhao Zhou had a sudden realization. Wu Men's commentary. Questioned by Zhao Zhou, Nan Chuan lost no time in showing the smashed tile and melted ice, where no explanation is possible. Though Zhao Zhou had realization, he could confirm it only after another 30 years of practice. Wu Men's verse. Hundreds of flowers in spring, the moon in autumn, a cool breeze in summer, and snow in winter. When the mind is not clouded with unnecessary things, that is your best season. Nan Chuan, whose dates are 720 to 814 of the Common Era, is one of the most eminent disciples of the legendary Mazu, along with his Dharma brothers, Bai Zhang and Layman Pang. And Zhao Zhou, whose dates are 778 to 897 of the Common Era, is, of course, his most famous successor. Nelson Foster's account of Nan Chuan's life from the Roaring Stream reads as follows. According to traditional accounts, he came to awakening some time before Ma Zhu's death in 788, spent a while on pilgrimage, and then at 48 retired to the top of Mount Nan Chuan to live in seclusion for the next 3 decades. His example helped such periods of cultivating the sacred seedling, the rule for upcoming Chan masters. Though not always so protracted, these intervals alone, or in the company of a few like-minded fellows, afforded opportunity not only to deepen in realization but also to study texts, to get some practice at teaching, and to season a bit, especially to eliminate the traces of enlightenment, the stink of Chan. It's the end of the quote. After one has attained a degree of insight, yes, it's good to let it set a while, to live not necessarily in seclusion, but an ordinary life, as did Wei Nung, for example, and Nyogen Senzaki, who lived for 20 years in obscurity after his teacher said farewell to him in San Francisco. It was while he was in this relatively secluded mountaintop retreat that Nan Chuan was sought out by a young, unordained novice, 17 years old. When the boy arrived, Nan Chuan was lying down and asked him, "Where do you come from?" The boy answered, "I have come from Shui Xiang Temple." Nan Chuan asked, "Have you seen the famous statue of the Buddha there?" The boy said, "I have seen no famous image. I see only the reclining Tathagata." At this point, Nan Chuan sat up and asked, "Are you a novice under a master or without a master?" The boy replied, "I am a novice with a master." Nan Chuan demanded, "Who is your master?" The boy said, "The winter cold now is very severe. I am so happy to see you enjoying good health, master." Thus, Chao Cho chose his master. There are many, many stories of the interactions between these two during their years together. And with each one, Nan Chuan became more convinced that here was not only a worthy disciple, but an eventual successor. And indeed, as time went on, their relationship became not so much that of master and disciple, but of colleagues, working together in the Dharma fields for the benefit of all beings. Two adepts playing both sides to arrive at the middle. Two arrows meeting in midair. But our story here is a little different. Here, Chao Cho is still a very young man, and he is sincerely asking his teacher for instruction. What is the Tao? Tao is usually translated as the way. Of course, that can have any of several meanings. The way things are, ultimate reality, or the way we live our lives, or yet again, the way to enlightenment. The Tao is at once the path and the goal. In ancient China, this word Tao subsumed such Indian Buddhist words as Buddha, Dharma, Samadhi, Shunyata. In fact, Tao has so many meanings that it transcends all meanings, like Mu or Om. Tao has become a word that goes beyond all words, all concepts and thoughts. So what is the Tao? The primordial question of questions. What is the true reality of my existence, and how do I find out? A question that is deep in all of us. It abides in everyone, whether they know it or not, whether they will ever know in this lifetime. It's a question that takes many forms. Who am I? Why am I here? Why was I born? What is this life really about? Is there an ultimate purpose to things, or am I just a random occurrence in an unfathomable, and uncaring universe. And how do I find out? Answers are many, but there is only this one question. Answers are short-lived. The question lives forever. Many people come to Zen practice after researching and trying various practices, philosophies, methods, and finding them to be unsatisfactory. There comes a point where every book you read, every lecture you go to, every New Age, Native American, Druidic, Wiccan, and yes, Buddhist talk or seminar becomes a dry exercise in intellectual futility. Somewhere in the pit of the stomach, there is a hollow place, a place where the question remains, a question that may well be impossible to put into words. In fact, it is more than a question. It is dukkha, suffering itself. There are koans aplenty in which this suffering is brought forth by a seeker. Case number 10 in the Wumen Guan, the monk Ching Shui said to Master Cao Shan, "I am solitary and destitute. Please give me alms." In case 41, Bodhidharma faced the wall. The second ancestor stood in the snow, cut off his arm, and said, "Your disciple's mind has no peace as yet. I beg you, Master, please put it to rest." Give me peace. Give me succor. Give me rest. Show me the way. Like many before and after him, Cao Zhou had studied doctrine extensively before his still unanswered question, his suffering, finally drove him south to seek a Chan master. And the incident of this koan is said to be, by most writers, to be an account of Cao Zhou's first great awakening experience. And it happened not too long after his arrival at Nanchuan's place. What is the Tao? Cao Zhou doesn't mince words here. Nothing about why the patriarch came from the West or what is that thing of special wonder. Just what is the way? What is it? And Nanchuan's answers. Ordinary mind is the Tao. Ordinary mind is the Tao. Well, that's one answer. In case number 30 in the Wumen Guan, Dai Mei asked Ma Zu, "What is Buddha?" Ma Zu answered, "This very mind is Buddha." But then, in case number 33, a monk asked Ma Zu, "What is Buddha?" Ma Zu answered, "Not mind, not Buddha." In case number 34, Nanchuan says, "Mind is not Buddha. Wisdom is not the Tao." Why don't these guys get their act together? It is the job of the Zen teacher not to allow the student anywhere to hang his or her hat. As soon as you get comfortable with an answer, the teacher whips it away, pulls out the rug. Did Nanchuan answer Cao Zhou's question? No. The question is unanswerable. Zen masters are not in the habit of answering questions. It is the way of the master not to answer the question, but to answer the student. The true teacher answers the situation in the here and now. Thomas Merton, commenting on the vow of obedience that he took upon becoming a Trappist monk, said that it is about obedience to the situation. We don't normally think of our teachers in this way, as obedient to anything. Quite the contrary. But in fact, the teacher is the one who does his or her best to serve the needs of the student in that moment, to be obedient to the situation. Nan Chuan does not answer the question. He answers Zhao Zhou. He answers the suffering. Ultimately, we must all learn to do this, to answer the situation out of our here and now practice, not to get caught up in either or, yes, no. Does the dog have Buddha nature or not? Does the enlightened person fall under the law of causality or not? We spend too much of our lives wandering in the impenetrable thickets of right and wrong. Should I, shouldn't I? Is it this or is it that? This is what happens when we abstract a question, words and concepts, from the reality of here and now. We ask such questions, what is the Tao? Who am I? What is Buddha? Out of our separation from ourselves. I don't think a tree spends a lot of time puzzling over what is a tree. Look at your hands right now. Are they sitting in your lap, wondering about whether they are really hands or not? What is the Tao? Ordinary mind is the Tao. Really? Ordinary mind? Do you mean this monkey mind with its chattering and grabbing? Crazy mind with its endless desires, anger and temper tantrums, schemes and dreams, delusions and confusions, and on and on? Yeah, that mind, the mind that we don't like very much, the mind that we're always trying to fix, make it better somehow. Polish it up with a little zazen here and there. Knock out some of the dents with a koan or two. And for those really tough stains, we got sesshin. Practice like that, and you will remain trapped forever. Let's look at it, this ordinary mind, with all its stuff, ideas, thoughts, scenarios, prejudices, assumptions, dreams and schemes. Look at this monkey mind that never stops chattering and grabbing. This is the way? Warts and all? If viewed properly, yes, it is. But the operative phrase here is if it is viewed properly. If it is viewed as pure experience, pure awareness, it is. Ordinary mind is the Tao. Everything we experience, hear, see, feel, taste, touch, or think is this mind. This is the whole of it. Yong Jia in Song of Enlightenment says, "The very nature of ignorance is the Buddha nature itself. The empty dilusory body is the very body of the Dharma." Is there anything outside of this mind? Is there anything that any of us experiences that is not in and of this mind? I dare you to show me anything that is outside of this mind, that is not mind itself. Now, we make a lot of assumptions and draw a lot of conclusions from what we see, hear, taste, etc. Assumptions and conclusions that are, for the most part, unwarranted. There's the old joke about two men riding on a train. One of them points out the window to a field they are passing and says, "Look, all the sheep out there have just been sheared." The second man says, "Well, they have on this side anyway." In commenting on that old saying, "Where there's smoke, there's fire," Philip Kaplow Roshi says, "No, where there's smoke, there's smoke." Now, these may sound like exaggerated examples, but the lesson is how much we habitually assume beyond our direct experience. In our practice, we learn to recognize and drop the assumptions, even though they too are mind. Oddly enough, some Western philosophers have come to the same conclusion. George Berkeley, an 18th century Irish bishop, made what was then a radical claim that there is no out there, or rather that there is no matter, only form. Gee, does that sound familiar? And that physical objects are just collections of perceptions to which we give names, such as apples or trees or people and so on. And these collections of perceptions have no existence apart from the perceiving mind. Dr. Samuel Johnson dismissed Berkeley's ideas by kicking a rock and saying, "I refute him thus." Of course, this did not refute anything. Berkeley didn't claim that the rock didn't exist or that kicking a rock will not produce a sensation. He claimed that the rock did not exist apart from the perception of its solidity or the perception of pain when it struck. And none of that is apart from mind. The problem is that Berkeley didn't go far enough. He might have gone on to say that just as objects do not exist without the perceiving mind, the mind has no existence apart from those perceptions. As Sung San says, "For things are things because of mind, as mind is mind because of things." And while Berkeley's assertions created a few ripples in philosophical thinking of the time, it never went any further than that. It was said that while his conclusion is irrefutable, it fails to convince. Why is that? Because he presented it as a purely intellectual speculation. There was no practice, no realization behind it. The fact that it cannot be refuted tells us something. This is not about science. It's not about trying to convince or persuade others with evidence and argument. That it fails to convince also tells us something. This is about spiritual insight, and that is a matter of personal experience only. Wu Men says, "You are like a mute person who has had a dream. You know it for yourself alone." And that knowing can only come out of practice. As one of our former members, Ron Green, used to like to say, what Berkeley said was the truth was true, but it was not the truth. It is only when such an insight arises as a self-evident truth out of one's own direct experience can it be said to be the truth. This is why a student may go into Doksan and present their understanding and be approved by the teacher. The next person may come in, make the same presentation to the same question, and be rejected. The teacher is not always looking for a particular action or a set of words. The teacher is looking for direct experience. Ordinary mind cannot be approached through intellection. This ordinary mind of Nanjuan, the Tao, this sum total of everything that we see, hear, taste, touch, and think, and nothing else, only when it is seen as direct experience, unencumbered, unassembled, uninterpreted, unnamed, and unattached. As soon as we try to go beyond and latch on to connected things, unhappiness arises, suffering. It's like trying to grasp the reflection of the moon in the water. It looks real and solid, but even as you reach for it, it breaks up and disappears, and there's nothing there but water. Now, if there is nothing outside this mind, then some other conclusions fall out of this. First is oneness, unity. If there is nothing outside this ordinary mind, then there can be only one of them. Postulating another mind or another anything is immediately putting something outside this one. This one! This ordinary mind is in fact the one mind, Buddha mind. It can be no other because there is no other. In fact, even the notion of one does not apply, not if it is to distinguish one from two or three and so forth. This is not a one that stands opposed to two or anything else. Another way to put it would be, throughout heaven and earth, I am the only one. Second is emptiness. If everything is mind and mind only, there is no other substance behind it. Phenomena are all manifestations of this one mind. To say something is real and apart is again to put something outside. It is to elevate thought objects to some kind of higher status outside this mind. Third, and this is really just a matter of observation, is transience. Nothing is fixed. Nothing is permanent. Can anyone name anything that exists constant and unchanged in this, in or as this mind for even a short period of time? I think that one of the most difficult things to let go of is this notion of permanence. We equate our vague and shifting thoughts about things with an abstract concept of some thing that has an unchanged existence of its own. In fact, our vague and shifting thoughts about anything are just that, vague and shifting thoughts, and that's all. If I see something changing, that something and that changing is not apart from myself. I am seeing myself changing. But gee, what of the unchanging, unborn, undying it? Paradoxically, the more clearly we see the transience, the impermanent nature of everything, the more we will connect with that unchanging, unborn, undying ground of being, or whatever you want to call it. The more clearly we see and accept the impermanence of everything, the more solidly we become anchored in the unchanging, that which cannot be named. So Zhao Zhou asked Nan Chuan, "What is the Tao?" And Nan Chuan answered, "Ordinary mind, that is the Tao." And that's it. This ordinary mind, the eternal and eternally changing and unchanging Buddha mind. And Zhao Zhou asks, "Then how do we get onto it?" Now, in light of what we've just been through about this ordinary mind, perhaps we can see that this is a non-question. There isn't any going toward or getting on to anything. We are already there. We are already it, and it is already us. One of the local TV stations used to have a slogan, "It's all right here." Makes you wonder. Chow Cho asks his question as one separated from the matter, and he does not yet see that Nan Chuan's answer is not an answer to the question. It is the Tao itself. But Nan Chuan will no longer answer directly. Here's how you do it. Here's how you will know about it. Signs of success or so forth. If you try to direct yourself toward it, you go away from it. Now, with this response of Nan Chuan's, we get into translation issues. The usual translations are something like, if you try to direct yourself toward it, you go away from it. Or, the more you seek after it, the more it runs away. But here's a problem. Can there be any going away from our own true mind? Can it run away from us? Can Buddha nature run toward or away from itself? And here is where Robert Aitken Roshi's translation helps us out. In his presentation in The Gateless Barrier, he has Nan Chuan answer, if you try to direct yourself, you betray your own practice. Yes, any thought about toward or away, any thought about a self to be directed anywhere, takes us into duality. It's certainly a misunderstanding of practice, if not a betrayal. Chow Cho, if we do not try, how can we know that it is the Tao? Now, there is knowing, and then there is knowing. Chow Cho has undoubtedly heard all the explanatory stuff, even as I have been blathering along here. How can we know? How can we realize this root, this fundamental ground of being? How can we get past all the words and phrases and concepts and images? How can we know the Tao? Good grief. How can we not know? The Zafu that you sit on knows all about being a Zafu, far more than you and I could possibly explain or expound. Does anybody seriously believe that you know more about the carpet in front of you than the carpet itself, about its origins, its history, its present makeup? The carpet knows it all by its very being. Every object, action, thought knows perfectly well what it is and will be. It is that knowing beyond knowing that we must learn to trust. If you're working on Mu, stop wondering about whether you're doing it right. Stop wondering about your position vis-a-vis Mu. Stop worrying about whether you're going toward or away. These are non-issues. Just Mu, the Tao, ordinary mind, is perfectly capable of taking care of itself. All we have to do is practice. But still, Chow Cho must ask, how can we know that it is the Tao? So Nan Chuan lets him have it. And again, notice that he pretty much ignores the actual question. The Tao does not belong to knowing or not knowing. Knowing is delusion, not knowing is blankness. If you truly reach the genuine Tao, you will find it as vast and boundless as outer space. How can there be knowing or not knowing in the Tao? And at these words, Chow Cho was suddenly enlightened. If you truly reach the genuine Tao, you will find it as vast and boundless as outer space. There is yet another language issue here. Space, as we normally use that word, implies distance, separation. There is object A, space, and then object B. That kind of space is an abstraction, just another notion. Space and objects are all phenomena. They are all one and the same. As one philosopher put it, a cup is what space is doing at that moment. There is no space apart from phenomena, and no phenomena apart from space. To say that the Tao is vast and boundless is to say that each and every phenomenon, object, thing, idea, thought, is vast and boundless. You and I are space, vast and boundless. Space is not separation or distance. Space is intimacy. Wu Min's commentary. Questioned by Zhao Zhou, Nan Chuan lost no time in showing the smashed tile and melted ice where no explanation is possible. Though Zhao Zhou had realization, he could confirm it only after another 30 years of practice. The smashed tile, the melted ice, no explanation possible. Ice, tiles, concepts, notions are all gone. Yes, the Tao, this ordinary mind, is not about knowing and not knowing right and wrong. And what's left? In one fell swoop, Nan Chuan has taken it all away. No explanation can reach it. And Wu Min continues, though Zhao Zhou had realization, he could confirm it only after another 30 years of practice. Wu Min is giving Zhao Zhou credit for a good beginning, but that's all. In the ox herding pictures, Kensho, the initial enlightenment experience, is represented by the third picture. The herdsman spots the tail of the ox waving from behind some bushes. Well, maybe Zhao Zhou saw a bit more than the tail. But even so, it's only the third picture out of 10. There is still a long, long way to go for all of us. That term 30 years in ancient Chinese is not really a specific number. When a Zen master says 30 blows, it doesn't mean he's going to count out as he whacks you 1, 2, 3, and so forth. 30 in ancient China was said in the same way that we say a ton today. If I have a ton of paperwork on my desk, it doesn't mean 2,000 pounds of paper. So Wu Min is saying 30 years, a long, long time. 30 years, forever. Wu Min's verse. Hundreds of flowers in spring, the moon in autumn, a cool breeze in summer, and snow in winter. When the mind is not clouded with unnecessary things, that is your best season. What a beautiful verse. Yeah, let this ordinary mind just be. Don't chase. Don't run away. Don't tinker. All we have to do with this ordinary mind is let it quiet down. Let it settle. Let the thoughts fade away as they will in our practice. And the truth appears, there being no delusion. Then every day is a good day. There's a little book called The Vegetable Root Discourse by a Chinese master named Hong Zicheng. In Robert Aiken's translation, one of his verses goes like this. When your mind is empty, your nature appears. Endeavoring to see into your nature with a discontented mind is like stirring up waves to see the moon. When thoughts are cleansed, the mind is pure. If you don't understand about the mind, you are like someone who tries to see reflections in a mirror by laying on more dust. Chertow writes, "If you do not see the way, you do not see it even as you walk on it." One could say that's a sad commentary on our situation, but at the same time, a very hopeful one. Hey, we're already there. All we have to do is see it clearly. How tough can that be? Ordinary mind is the Tao, is not an answer to a question. It's an answer to Zhao Zhou and to each of us. More than that, it is the Tao itself, and it is Nan Chuan, it is Zhao Zhou, and it is each one of us. It is nothing special, nothing we have to attain that we don't have. We have it all right here, right now. The mind cannot be fixed. It doesn't need fixing. This mind is the complete and utterly self-evident truth. And it is wonderful, beyond description. If we drop all the knowing, all the not knowing, we see that we ourselves are a wondrous, magical, shifting, phantasmagoric tapestry of the ever-changing, ever the same reality that is here and now, the infinite here, the eternal now. Together with all beings, we attain Buddhahood.